Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is 9 News KUSC-TV anchor reporter, Kyle Clark. Kyle, good morning.
Good morning to you, John. Good to be with you in your podcast community.
Hey, thanks for being on the show. I have been a big fan of yours. The reason I wanted to ask you on the show is because, first, I'm very impressed with the work you do as a news anchor and reporting. And you do something in a new, relatively new show called Next, where you do some context and analysis of the news, which is what we try to do with the Mac Observer in our coverage of Apple. So I want to talk to you about that in the second segment of the show. So,
all right.
Were you always interested in news broadcasting? Was that something that you glommed onto at an early age?
You know, I think I was always interested in learning and in explaining things to people. My parents were both teachers, so I think I picked that up from them. They always stressed the importance of constantly learning and then being able to explain to other people what you know so that then they can learn. And I think that kind of led me toward journalism.
Boy, that sounds awfully familiar. That's a skill that's really important these days with technology exploding the way it is and being able to explain news and in context and technology to people. That's awesome.
Yeah, and I just think so many people in so many fields of work, if you can have the common element that you love to learn, you have a really good chance of being satisfied in your job.
So did you major in journalism in college toward this end?
I did. I majored in journalism at Ithaca College with a minor in politics.
At that time, what were you thinking about what you were going to do? Did you think you were going to go into print? Did you have sort of a career plan? Were you like working at a local TV station or something, kind of warming up? What was happening?
I think I considered a little bit of everything. I considered sports broadcasting. I considered print reporting. My first broadcasting job was actually at the age of 15 at a farm radio station, a little 5,000-watt AM radio station in western New York, where I would come in and I would play the commercial breaks for the pizza shop and the local insurance company during the Yankees broadcast. And kind of got hooked on broadcast that way and got interested in radio. And radio is obviously it's a great way to learn how to communicate because it's so stripped down.
So radio is a very, and television is kind of a technical era. Were you simultaneously geeking out with computers too?
You know, not as much as some of my classmates. I mean, to me, I think computers have always been a tool to be used. I mean, are you dating yourself if you reveal how young you are? But I guess my first computer, I might bungle the name here, but I think it was an Apple 2GS that my dad brought home from the school when they no longer had use for it. And my father, who is, bless him, still not super computer literate, did impress upon me the importance of learning computers from an early age. Basically brought it home and said, learn how to use this thing. You're going to need to know. And I've always viewed technology as a tool more so than a pastime.
You're not the only guest who's told me that their parent brought an Apple II home and they started playing with it. This is a common thread, and it has been an inspiration for many of my guests. It's amazing. So as you sort of evolved into thinking about doing broadcasting, were you watching TV news and learning from people and sort of saying, well, I think that news anchor is so cool, I want to be like that?
I was definitely watching the news. I don't know if I was thinking about it in terms of I would like to do that. But my parents, the teachers, were constantly saying you need to be informed about the world around you. And what that meant is that in, I think it was 89, 90, 91, when the first Gulf War was happening, they had me down in front of a TV watching Peter Jennings and Peter Arnett and people like that talking about the first Gulf War. And I was a grade schooler, but they said that that was important. So I think from an early age, I was exposed to the value of that work.
Well, that takes me into an interesting subject. I'm going to insert something here that I wasn't planning on asking you, but I went through the same process when I was in middle school. I had some teachers who were very insistent that I subscribe to Time Magazine or Newsweek and be alert and informed about what was going on in the world. And my generation sort of felt like, you know, there were facts out there that you could learn about and would inform your perspectives about the world. And recently, those facts have become kind of fuzzy in terms of objective reality. Any thoughts on that?
I still believe that facts exist, if that's what you're asking me.
Yes. Yes.
Yes, I believe that facts exist. I'm reminded of something that a CU scientist said to us recently. I think that we were discussing climate change or something along the lines. But he said, science doesn't care if you believe in it. And in the same way, facts
don't
believe.
Oh, that's Neil deGrasse Tyson. Oh, he got that from Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Oh, he totally cribbed him on that one.
Yes, he did.
Yes. Now, I had not heard Neil deGrasse Tyson say that, but that's funny because that's so resonated with me. It just occurs to me when somebody will say, you know, I can't believe that you put that in your report, and I don't believe that that's true. Mm-hmm. I always try to reply to people and say, mm-hmm. I appreciate where you're coming from, but your belief in a fact does not make it more or less true. It simply is.
That's an interesting perspective, and that's a truth that I try to put into my writing as well. So you were in Rochester, New York at WHAM. What were you doing there before you came to Denver?
I was a general assignment reporter. Yep, that was in my hometown, working with the folks that I grew up watching, which was just invaluable. One, working in your hometown, so you kind of have the advantage of knowing the lay of the land. And two, getting up close and personal with people that you viewed as legends when you were a kid. And you learned that they're people like anybody else with good and bad, and they were all great teachers.
This is one of those assignments, I take it, where they tell you, we need you out at the airport at 11 o'clock tonight and stand in front of the terminal and do a report on such and such, right? With microphone in hand and snow.
Yes, indeed.
Yes.
Yep.
Is that how it goes? How did you feel about that? Did you feel like that was it just part of the ropes of learning the trade?
Well, sure. And sometimes there's value in that for the viewer, for the consumer. There's not always value in that. Oftentimes there's not. But sometimes there is. And my goal was to try and find the value or the nugget in every assignment. And sometimes that meant they would say, the story is X, and I would get out there and say, well, I think the story is Y, but I'll give you just enough X to keep you happy, but let me tell you about Y today.
That's that curiosity and that thirst for learning where you go, what's going on here? What's one level deeper? Huh?
Sure. And understanding that if everybody is reporting or saying the same thing, then what are you really telling or teaching or explaining to anyone?
Yeah, we call it the echo chamber here at the Mac Observer.
Yep.
So how did Channel 9 learn about you? Did they recruit you and bring you out?
It's actually kind of a funny story. I had talked to a sister station of 9 News in Buffalo, New York for years about a job. And incidentally, had never taken a job with them because I was very happy in my hometown and kind of frustrated. The news director there eventually said to me, well, if you don't want to work for me, who do you want to work for? And I mentioned KUSA in Denver and KARE, K-A-R-E, in Minneapolis as two of just the great local TV stations in the country. Really smart markets, really connected communities, great photojournalism, great investigative reporting. And I think it was a week later that I got a call from the boss at KUSA who said, I hear you're interested.
Did you come out as a general assignment reporter also?
I did. Full bottom rung. Weekend evening general assignment reporter back in 07.
So it took from then until now for you to... Well, when did you become an anchor? Was it just a few years ago, right?
Well, I think I first started anchoring about 2 to 3 years after I arrived. There was some staff turnover, and I anchored the weekend morning show for about two weeks.
That's
and
when
then
you
I
guys
anchored the
started.
Weekend evening show.
Yeah. You guys started at 6 a.m. on Sunday morning doing news, right?
Exactly. And you say, well, you know, you pay your dues, but I am in no way going to claim that I did on that program because I was on it for all of 2 weeks, and then a local legend, Ward Lucas, retired. Mm-hmm. After 33 years at KUSA, and I slid into his weekend evening slot and worked there for a couple of years.
Is there a stated progression, or is it happenstance? I mean, is there like a career plan at the station where they say, look, you do this, and then here's your career progression, and if you do well, you move up to that, and then here are the people who are ahead of you, and if they retire, you're in line, or do they kind of leave it loose and give themselves more latitude on that?
I think if you ask my bosses, they would say it is all very carefully planned and choreographed. And just between you and me, I would say it absolutely is not.
That sounds right.
it's very much based on the needs of the moment. And because, again, we're talking about people, and we're talking about an organization, an ecosystem that, while it is several hundred people large, my particular corner of it, which is reporting and anchoring, is only a few dozen people large. So you're dealing with people's personal circumstances, and people retire early, and they follow family to other cities, or they decide to take a job elsewhere. So there's probably a well-made plan somewhere. It just doesn't get implemented.
So I'm curious about, because you're a young person in TV news and broadcasting, how your technical background, your experience with the Apple IIs and technology has influenced how you approach the news. It's one thing to be curious. It's another thing to have and sort of bring a technical bent. Are there technical requirements for you behind the scenes that you want to talk about, like how you develop your scripts or technology you use, like the Skype call?
Yeah, I think more than anything, it's just technological competence and a willingness to learn. Because just in the 10 years that I've been at Nine News, we're constantly dealing with new iterations of technology, some of which are owned and developed by our parent company, some of which are standard consumer technology. And I think more than anything else, the requirement is just that you are flexible and that you are willing to learn. I mean, I would consider myself to be somewhat of a digital native just due to my age and my interest in technology. And I think that's a great stumbling block for a good number of people from a previous generation of reporters, because they mastered the job without the daily plug-in to that 24/7 audience feedback, filing digitally first. And Twitter. I imagine, yes, and I imagine that's a tremendously difficult transformation for them to make. I was fortunate in the sense that I went from IMing and texting my friends to tweeting the public.
You know, when we watch TVs and shows and movies, we sort of see this mythical meme of the TV news anchor who just shows up, looks good, reads the news. You do not do that. Oh, you look good, I guess I'd say. But you bring a certain depth and wit to the news that I admire, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you.
I appreciate that.
And so tell me, what have been some of the most notable moments for you at KUSA?
Boy, it's tough to pick. It's tough to pick favorites. I think I tend to gravitate toward the things where I hear from viewers, "Oh, hey, I noticed that you exist." Because a lot of the daily journalism that I inhale. Separated from the bylines. I don't always notice the bylines. And then there's other journalism that I consume because I seek out the bylines. They're people that I know and that I trust. So when I think back on my time at KUSA, I think about stories where basically viewers have said, "Hey, thank you. I'll seek out your byline now." I think about a fire in early January of 2008 in Boulder, right along the diagonal highway there, where we were out live for hours as the fire was burning down over the tops of the foothills and coming down toward the highway. And I heard from viewers saying, "You gave me perspective I could not have gotten anywhere else. Thank you. I will look for your work in the future." I think about the hours that I spent on the anchor desk when a colleague was out and I was called to sub, and the balloon boy incident happened, the hoax where the family claimed that a young boy was floating in an enormous balloon over Colorado. and I heard from people, "Thanks for helping us sort that out, for trying to avoid speculation." And then also the night and the day of the Aurora Theater shooting, when we were on the air from, I think I joined Kyle Dyer on the air around 5 a.m. and we were off around 11 or 11:30 that night, and heard from people saying, you know, "Appreciate the fact that you guys were there with us for the duration. And again, that you helped us sort fact from fiction," because that truly was a dual screen experience for people in the community, because they were watching things roll in front of them via Twitter and Facebook, but then they were looking to legacy media like a local TV station to help sort fact from fiction.
Amazing. Yeah, when you work that hard and you have that much passion, it's really nice to get feedback from people and say, "Wow, you did a great job." It's got to be satisfying.
It's good to be useful. I mean, because there's a lot of great work, and I'm not saying that I do great work, but there's a lot of great work in all numbers of fields that just simply is not widely consumed or enjoyed or appreciated by people. So it's one thing to feel like you're doing work that matters, and it's another thing to know that people are actually appreciating it and finding it useful.
You remind me a lot of Bill Stewart from Channel 4. I don't know if you remember him. He retired maybe 7 or 8 years ago. He had this barely constrained sarcasm and sense of humor that was under visible control at all times. Occasionally it burst forth. How many chances do you get as a news anchor to kind of lose it and still keep your job?
I will let you know.
It'll be a visible effect.
I can tell you the answer is more than the number of times I've done it, but yet there must be a ceiling somewhere.
There must be. All right. Well, we're coming to the end of the first segment here, and we're going to take a short commercial break for a second. And when we come back, I want to talk to you about your new show, relatively new show, Next, and some other things. Folks, we'll be right back. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage, where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thanks, Kelly. We're back. I'm chatting with Kyle Clark from KUSA Channel 9 News. So you have, I want to dig into something here that's kind of fun. I read that you have an interest in beer in a special kind of way. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I got into craft beer when I was living in Western New York, and honestly, it's one of the things that first got me to take a look at Denver and Colorado as a place to live, and the burgeoning craft beer community here, which now tops 300 breweries. And I really enjoy craft beer at every angle. I mean, from sitting around with a great beer, but also the great company. I enjoy the process and talking to the makers in that process, and I find it to just be a really interesting mix of people. As you go around Denver and you visit craft breweries, there are places that are filled with young families. There are other places that are filled with young professionals. There are neighborhood type breweries. There is a heavy metal brewery in Denver. And I find that people are universally welcome to all of them. And that's really cool.
That is cool. The best beer I ever had in my whole life was at the Thirsty Bear in San Francisco. It was vanilla beer. Is that common? Can I get that anywhere?
Sure. There are a number of brewers in Colorado that have vanilla beers. I'm trying to think of somebody who bottles or packages it. I know that Breckenridge has a vanilla porter that's out there. But no, the use of different types of ingredients and flavorings and varying your grains and your hops and that sort of thing, that's what makes craft beer interesting, because it's a constantly evolving field with all kinds of different variations. And I grow hops in my backyard, and I homebrew as well. So I enjoy the work of the pros, and I also make some pretty amateurish attempts myself.
That's interesting, because it's a common thread with us here at the Mac Observer. Many of us, most of us, are Scotch fans. I'm a single malt Scotch nutcase. And so that's kind of interesting about how we roll in the broadcast community. Cool. Well, I want to move on and talk about Next. You have this fairly new show called Next. For the listeners, it's replaced the 5 o'clock news repeat that normally had occurred at 6 o'clock, which was kind of like an encore performance. And now at 6 o'clock in Denver, you have this kind of news magazine analysis context show. I don't recall seeing that at other stations. Maybe other stations have done that. But I was impressed, and I wanted to ask you, how did the concept of the Next show develop? Did you think that up and pitch it, or did the news director ask you to do it?
It's something that I've been envisioning and working on with colleagues, in our minds at least, for the better part of 3 years. And it's something that I pitched to Nine News Management and then also pitched to our corporate ownership, which 3 years ago was the Gannett Company and is now Tegna, the broadcast spinoff of Gannett. And over time, ended up getting everybody's full buy-in to do something different.
Was it a hard sell?
Well, any change is hard, I think it's especially hard to convince people to change a successful product. And I want to give my bosses credit where credit is due, because they were not taking a ratings loser off the air to take a flyer on something. They took a highly successful newscast and said, go ahead and turn this into something different, something that's based on what viewers tell us they want, what you're saying you would like to be able to do and better serve the community. And I give them credit, because they could have put it on our sister station in the middle of the night. But instead, they put it on the flagship, and they put it on at 6 p.m., said, well, here you go. Try not to mess it up.
This is a staggering evolution, because, as we all know, TV stations are very sensitive about ratings. They pore over them in detail. They compare them to the competition, their competition for Emmy Awards. And so, yes, as you said, to take a 6 o'clock primetime news show off the air and insert this magazine show that you do alone, along with weather, was a great leap of faith and a lot of confidence in you. I'm amazed.
Well, we have a terrific team that has worked on this show, and I headline the thing, but it's based on the contributions of so many different people that you see, reporters, people that you don't see, photographers and producers. And a lot of it started with just asking people who are inside the business a simple question, which is, what would you like to do every day? What would be most meaningful and purposeful for you? And then asking our viewers the same thing, which is, what do you want? And now, of course, sometimes what people say they want and what they actually want are two different things. But I think for a long time, journalism, and especially TV news, has been governed by, you show up at this time and we will tell you what we think you need to know. And that's going away. And it doesn't mean that we simply chase the whim and desire of every Facebook popularity poll and show people cat videos. But I do think what that means is that there has been a democratization of the process, and that any process that does not respect the consumer is bound to fail, or at least be steadily diminished.
So how much preparation do you have to do for next? When do you show up at work, and how many hours does it take to get ready to do a show?
Next is still in its infancy, so all of us who are working on the show are basically working on it around the clock. The show goes on at 6, it goes off at 6:30, and 6:31 is when we begin the preparation for the next day. I'm also preparing for our 9 and 10 o'clock newscasts, our flagship newscasts. I do those as well. But then when I'm up in the morning, the first thing that I'm doing is talking to the folks on the next team who are working in the morning about, what are the stories that we're preparing? When do you need me? What do you need me on? What phone calls can I be making? What can I be researching? And so it's pretty nonstop at this point, but that's because it's young. It's a startup.
Has the show evolved in any way significant since you started the show? Things you've learned to do and not to do?
I think the show has evolved in the sense that the viewers enjoyed early on kind of being in on the joke of, here we go on this grand adventure together, wonder if this ship is going to sink or if it's going to float. And then I think over time, what we've heard from viewers is, no, we're here for the long haul. You better be here for the long haul, too. Let's get down to business.
Nice. So you mentioned earlier in the show that you were working with your colleagues and other anchors, possibly, was that right, to sort of evolve this show. So I take it you've had full support of everybody else, right? This is sort of like, this is all of us working together to support you to do this because we believe in it too.
That's certainly how it's felt. And one of the really encouraging things about this is, as somebody who came into the business sometimes 20 years after some of my other colleagues, what I've heard from them is, I think I see what you're trying to do here. And I've heard from them that just as they came into journalism 30 years ago and steered it in one direction, they see that a new generation is coming in and steering things in a different direction, and they don't see that as a loss of control or any type of repudiation of what they did, but simply an echoing of what they did, which is to try to make the profession and the business relevant for a new generation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Have you seen anybody try to copy your attempts at any other stations?
You know, I know that there are other stations around the country that are interested in what we're doing because they call me and we have conversations about it.
Oh, cool.
News is a business in which imitation is constant because everybody's chasing the same mm-hmm. audience. To be honest with you, just with the schedule of the new show, I'm watching less news than I have before because I'm producing more. So I couldn't tell you what other folks are doing.
Okay. Well, it's pretty cool what you're doing with Next. I wish you all luck with that. I'm a big fan, and I think you're doing great work. So in the few minutes we have left, I want to kind of transition very shortly into some technology items. You mentioned to me before that you had sort of a contrarian view of the iPhone for years, and you haven't been a user until recently. How did you get that contrarian view, and what was going on there?
You know, I'm going to take us back to where we started with my folks who were teachers who always told me that there's nothing wrong with being on the thin side of an argument. And I've always enjoyed being somebody who would offer a contrasting view or contrasting opinion. I think with the iPhone for the longest time, I avoided it because it was so popular.
Yeah, but the Android phone has really got the market share. It's the popular one.
It does. No, I mean, if you look at the pure numbers, it does now. I was a BlackBerry guy for a long time.
Oh, my condolences.
And I tell you what, I would have defended that device to the death until I would say roughly 12 hours after I got my first iPhone. And I just quietly said to myself, well, you know, sometimes what's popular is also best.
Well, you know, our managing editor, Jeff Gamet, has been in the studio and has helped with producing some tech input. And I think he mentioned that he had met you a couple times. He was, along with me and the publisher and the co-founder, were at Macworld on January 9th, 2007. And I was sitting next to my publisher, and Jeff wasn't far away. And I was sitting there watching Steve Jobs unveil this phone. And I was going, oh, my God, oh, my God. I don't care how much it costs. Steve wouldn't tell us how much it was going to cost until the very end. And I'm going, I'm going to have one. I don't care how much it costs. And then across the aisle, our managing editor is talking to a CBS newbie who's glommed on to Jeff because he's kind of learning the ropes. And he wants to know what's going on. And Steve talks about how you now have an iPod. You have an internet communication device on the internet, and you have a telephone and a touchscreen display with no buttons. And this guy turns to Jeff and he says, oh, what is Steve talking about? What just happened here? And Jeff turns to him and says, short answer, Apple just made your BlackBerry obsolete.
Yes.
And they did. And BlackBerry's almost gone. So those kinds of disruptions are the legacy of Apple Computer. So you mentioned you also do some electronics tinkering at home. Does that involve maybe some 4K stuff or something else?
So I have a newer 4K TV, which sadly use out of a Vizio.
Uh huh.
And I do not know a tremendous amount about it because I don't get to watch a lot of TV.
Does it have HDR? It's probably too old, right? High dynamic range.
I do not believe that it does. To be honest with you, I have played with it very little. All of my technology work recently has been around some smart home tinkering. I am so fascinated by it, and I'm so geeked out about it, which is funny because I am not a tech geek. Again, they've just always been tools, but the idea of what we can do now to automate our homes around us is so fascinating to me.
Yeah. CES 2017 just finished, and our team was out there learning all about home automation. Big time stuff, Internet of Things.
Absolutely. And I love how this year at CES, it's like, well, maybe now we should secure our smart homes. And it's like, yeah,
maybe we should.
That's a good idea. You know, come to think of it, yeah.
So what do you think are some of the hot buttons as you cover the technology news? You cover a lot of different things, but when it comes to technology reporting, what do you think some of the hot things are going to be in 2017? Do you think the fake news thing is going to come and go, or is it here to stay? And what are your thoughts on things we should be focusing on this new year?
I think fake news as a phrase is going to come and go very quickly. I think that it was so quickly co-opted and twisted by the folks who felt like they were targeted by the term fake news that they have rendered that term obsolete for purposes of conversation. And I think the journalists would be better served by simply returning to core tenets of journalism and stop trying to operate with the cover of that buzz phrase. I think it's a fascinating time in the sense that I get the sense that people are remarkably distrustful of institutions, yet for the sake of convenience, will turn over their privacy and their information and everything else to those same very institutions. Mm-hmm. It's a really interesting time.
Yes, it is. We had an incident early in 2015 where the Apple had a kerfuffle with the FBI about encryption. And that's a big subject of discussion. We've covered it intensively at the Mac Observer. Are you following this issue of the government wanting to have backdoors into our phones and Apple's championing of a perfect encryption to keep us safe and secure?
I have followed it on a very shallow level in the sense that I don't report daily on tech. I'm interested in it just as a tech user. I think the most interesting thing to me was just the FBI had some really solid ground, perhaps the most terra firma it would ever find with that San Bernardino case. And the fact that Apple got out of that period of public discussion without being forced to capitulate is probably really good news for Apple, because I can't think of a better case for the FBI to have argued on than the San Bernardino terrorism case.
Right. Yeah, it's an ongoing issue. I had Chris Segoyan on, who was advisor for the ACLU recently, and he talked about the government efforts to push the limits. We had an interesting show talking about that. It was fun. That'll be on soon. So I've got one more item here, and we've kind of covered this, but I want to kind of just circle back and close with it. There are people who will tell you that local TV news is on the way out, that it's for old people, that there are new ways of communicating. We have Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and other news outlets, and nobody watches TV news anymore unless they want to be inundated with medical commercials. But you've breathed new life into it in my mind, and you've created that new connection. What's your prognosis for the future of local TV news?
I would say that as somebody who is in my early 30s and wants to stay in journalism for my career lifetime, I work in the information business. I happen to work for a media company that is primarily composed of local TV news stations, and much of what I do every day is content that is prepared for a local TV newscast. That said, we also put it live, or we put it in its entirety on YouTube every day, which is not something that TV news has done for a long time, because we thought, well, that would take eyeballs away, and we need those eyeballs on the commercials, as opposed to, no, we need people to know and trust our content so that they will seek us out. I'm in the business of information on Twitter and on Facebook and on YouTube and on whatever is next. My guess would be that my career and the careers of people my age will outlast local TV news. And to that I say, so be it. If we're in the business of journalism and information, then that's the business that we're in. And it needs to be somewhat platform agnostic. And I also think that a lot of the hand-wringing over how will we monetize journalism, how will we keep this going, those are critical conversations to have. But they are not the consumer's problem. I understand the idea of inviting people to participate in paying for the journalism that they consume. I do that with a lot of the journalism that I consume. I think we also know that there is a limit to how much that can be done. But again, that's our problem to solve. The baseline is people are hungry for information and news now more so than ever, and it's our job to figure out how to get it to them.
Wow. What a wonderful encapsulation of the issue. That's the best description I've ever heard. Awesome. Well, guess what? We're out of time. We covered just about everything. This has been amazing. Thank you so much for being on the show. This has been quite a grand tour of your work and your career in the news industry and local television. Thank you.
It truly has been my pleasure. Thank you.
Tell the listeners how to contact you if they would like to.
Certainly. You can find me on Twitter at Kyle Clark, K-Y-L-E-C-L-A-R-K. You can email me, kyle@ninenews.com. That is the numeral nine. Don't find me on Facebook. I'm inundated there, and I like Twitter better anyway.
All right. Cool. Well, thanks again, and thank you, listeners, for coming by. We'll see you next time on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.